Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
New York Times columnist Joe Nocera is filling out his March Madness brackets. Or maybe I should say he's bracketing the maddest things that the NCAA has done to its college athletes to see which one is the most maddening of all. Nocera has been on a late-season tear of tearing into what he calls stupid NCAA tricks, as well as writing about some of his other frequent muses, like who's getting off too easy on Wall Street, and why fracking and the Keystone XL pipeline can be done responsibly. We'll talk about those things and maybe even more as we welcome Joe Nocera back to WNYC to begin our show this Friday. Hi, Joe.
Well, thanks, Brian. You made me sound like a complete nut.
I did? No, I thought I made the NCAA sound like complete nuts. And we'll get to that. But let's begin with your usual beat, which is Wall Street. The news this morning is that consumer prices for February, just out today, and up by the most in 10 months, mostly because of higher gasoline prices. My question is, are you worried at all about inflation with the stock market surging and the Fed already guaranteeing those very low interest rates for another 2 years?
I'm not. I think gas prices, gas prices are obviously inflationary, but, gas prices are being driven by, issues around Iran, speculation, China. It's not being driven by kind of the inflationary impulses that drove inflation in the 70s. It's a commodity that goes up and down, and it's inflicting pain right now, but it's not really a deeper inflationary thing to worry about, I don't think.
But if the economy is starting to grow again, conservative economists especially seem to be worried that because the Fed is saying, hey, we're not going to raise interest rates from near zero until after 2014, that is a formula for inflation.
Well, it could be, and there's no question that the Fed would have to be willing to change its policies if they started to see inflationary creep. But as long as it's only gas prices, as long as it's being driven by the price of a barrel of oil, as opposed to food, as opposed to all the other items that make up the core inflation, it's really not a problem right now.
And they do say in these stats this morning that what they call core inflation, as opposed to a commodity like oil, is tame. Hey, what did you think about that op-ed in the Times by Greg Smith, a 33-year-old Goldman Sachs executive who left the company and on his last day accused it on the pages of the New York Times of basically trying to rip off its clients rather than serve them?
Well, on the one hand, it's not really news. On the other hand, it's astounding that somebody from the inside would say it. And that's why it had such an effect over the last 2 days. And certainly everybody on Wall Street and off Wall Street is talking about it. Just recently we had this El Paso deal where, Goldman was on essentially both sides of the transaction, and one banker actually had stock in the other company, Kinder Morgan, in the acquirer. And you would think that would be a conflict so rife that it would disqualify him. But Goldman, Goldman is Goldman. Goldman thinks they can play all sides. Goldman thinks they can, decide who's a client and who's a counterparty, even though the client may not know that they're being viewed as a counterparty. And Goldman's essential view is their job is to make money, and they're very good at it.
That's really interesting. And one of the themes of your book about the financial crisis, All the Devils Are Here, was that clashes would mount between sophisticated investors who feel they got duped and the Wall Street firms who knew more than they let on about how many of their mortgage securities were likely to fail. So is Greg's – go ahead.
That's what's playing out now in the regulatory arena with the SEC and also with litigation, with firms basically saying they were duped and that these mortgage securities, that the firm should buy them back. Fannie and Freddie is also a big player in this. Basically sending mortgages back, saying we want our money back for this because this is a much worse mortgage than you had let on.
So, listeners, we'll take calls on three topics for Joe Nocera today: anything about Wall Street, how the NCAA rules abuse college athletes, and his support for the Keystone XL pipeline and for fracking, which we'll get to. That ought to keep us going all weekend. We've got about 20 minutes in real life. So call right now with anything about Wall Street, how the NCAA rules treat college athletes, and Joe's support for fracking and the Keystone XL pipeline, 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And on to March Madness and the NCAA's permanent madness. While other people were watching number one Syracuse almost lose to a 16 seed yesterday, I was reading your blog post on the subway where you invited readers last month to a Nocera blog contest to find the stupidest NCAA tricks, like stupid pet tricks. What prompted that contest?
Well, so many of the rules are just petty and idiotic. They're just beyond belief that you would have rules about whether rowers can bet their shirts, which is a long-time tradition, or whether that violates NCAA policy. It's just some of the things athletes get punished for are just insane. Insane. And, you know, the NCAA, I was actually at North Carolina this week, and I sat next to a football player who just graduated, and he had been suspended for 4 games because he had to use somebody else's credit card for a flight because, you know, he didn't have his own credit card, and he paid the money back and everything. But that's, you know, an impermissible benefit because he, quote-unquote, violated his amateur status. The serious point here, Brian, which is that why every student on a campus has certain rights, and every American in the country has certain rights, and yet athletes are deprived of these rights on a systematic basis when they go to play college sports. And my big point, they lose rights of due process, they lose rights of free association, they lose rights of privacy, and you know, they get punished for no reason. This poor kid from Syracuse, 6'10" center Fab Milo, he's been suspended on the eve of the tournament for quote unquote academic issues, which we don't know what they are. We don't know what the backstory is. But, you know, why would you do it on the eve of the tournament? Why? It's punitive and it humiliates the athlete, and it's a terrible thing to do to the fans, for that matter. And you're basically saying to Syracuse, we're not going to let you compete in the tournament with the team that you had all year because we've chosen this moment to punish this athlete in a very public and humiliating way.
Because he did what?
Nobody knows.
Really?
Academic issues. Nobody knows.
Oh, academic
nobody
issues.
Knows.
An example you gave as a contender in the stupidest NCAA rule. This must have been a number one seed, or at least a number one seeded role. And that was that it's okay for a coach to give a player a bagel, but not okay if it's a bagel with cream cheese. Can you explain that?
I can't explain it. I cannot explain it. But there is a rule about, you know, you can give fruit, bread, or something else, but you can't give spreads.
Dave in Manhattan. Go ahead.
Even the NCAA knows this rule is so stupid that they're actually going to get rid of it. The other rule that really, the one that should have won is, you know, Nebraska was penalized and put on probation because its athletes were not only getting the books that were required for their classes, they were being given the books that were recommended by the professors as well.
Whoa.
it's like, what are they? I thought we wanted our athletes to succeed in the classroom.
To maybe learn something. David in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Joe Nocera. Hello.
This is my constant beef. Thank you for taking the call. Here are these kids, and they are just kids. They're standing around, and they're looking at billions and billions of dollars being bet, being made, and they get a college scholarship, which is nice. But for goodness sakes, if these guys didn't show up, if these guys all decided not to play, there's no money. There's nothing. They don't get a piece of any of this. And,
I'm so glad you're saying this.
It still costs an outrageous amount of money to go to college. Where's the money that's supposedly lowering tuition for everybody else? So why shouldn't these guys get paid? Please.
Well, I'm so happy to hear you say that. That is certainly my view. College football and men's basketball combined is a $6 billion industry. $6 billion. It's bigger than the NBA. March Madness is going to generate for the NCAA $800 million. That's how the NCAA funds itself through this three-week tournament. Turner Broadcasting and CBS have paid $10 billion for the rights to this tournament. And coaches make – everybody's getting rich off the backs of an unpaid labor force, many of whom come from disadvantaged backgrounds and are basically lambs to be slaughtered by the system. And so I completely agree with the listener that the players, as a matter of morality, as a matter of justice, and as a matter of economics, the players should be paid.
And in one of your columns, you embrace the idea of student athletes as young as in high school being able to hire agents. Do you really want those sharks swimming in the living rooms of 15-year-olds?
Yes, let's talk about that for a minute. I think that's an important issue. One of the reasons they're sharks is because they can't do this legally. In hockey, even though it's against the rules, every 13- and 14-year-old kid has an agent. That's just the ethos of hockey. It's the way it works. I don't see any big hockey scandals coming out of this. It's because kids have to make decisions about their lives when they're 15 or 16 years old. Are they going to go to a junior Canadian league? Are they going to go to a professional league? Are they going to go to college? You know, they need advice. You know, African-American basketball players from disadvantaged backgrounds who are 16 years old, they need advice. The NCAA the NCAA is deeply suspicious of single-parent households where the athlete has a male mentor. They just view the male mentor as a bad guy. That's just the way they think. And so those kind of situations get investigated, and the athlete often gets punished. If you had a system where you had a list of approved agents who were there to help the athlete get through these difficult, make smart choices and get through this difficult decision, and you're not having the 17-year-old kid have to fend for himself, which, by the way, is what the system wants. They want these kids to be defenseless.
So they don't
want them to have help. So it's in their best interest to characterize the system of agents and runners as sleazy. Well, it is sleazy, but that's partly because the rules have been set up in a way to force them to be sleazy.
I said people can call in on NCAA, Wall Street, and we'll get to your positions on fracking and Keystone XL in support for the most part. Jima in Manhattan has a Wall Street question. Hello, Jima.
It's actually Zima with a V.
I'm so sorry. Hi.
That's okay. I'm a small investor. By small, I mean under $100,000. That I have put away a retirement as such. And I wonder if, even in terms of a small investor, if a financial advisor or whatever he considers himself, he's a good guy, directs me constantly, I think, towards things that his company is invested in. He runs things by me that are, do I want to invest in China, Brazil, whatever, things like that. So I do have a say in the matter, but we end up buying things that I think sometimes are reflections of his company's investments.
Zima, I'm so glad you called, because, Joe, when we talk about a revelation from the inside that Goldman, or at least an accusation from the inside, that a firm like Goldman is not working on behalf of its clients, and we think about these huge investors, institutional investors, sophisticated investments who had toxic mortgage securities and stuff like that. What about the millions of Americans out there like Zima, little folks with a little retirement money who have a broker and now are wondering, well, are they working against my best interest? Are they just trying to rip me off with the advice that I get?
Well, Zima, if you feel that way, you need a new advisor. I mean, it's really that simple. If you can't be confident that your advisor is giving you advice that is aligned with your interest as opposed to the interest of the firm, you need to find someone else. There are lots of independent financial advisors who are not affiliated with any firm who get paid maybe 1% of your assets per year, and are not paid based on whether they make a trade or whether they put you in a particular investment or not. And I would strongly advise you, if you feel that way, to try and find somebody like that. I myself, I'm going to confess, had for many years a financial advisor who worked for Citigroup. She was formerly with Smith Barney. She's retired now. And, you know, what I admired about her was she never, ever, ever said to me, why don't you invest in something that Smith Barney is pushing? And this probably hurt her at the firm, but it was that kind of integrity that I was looking for. And, you know, whatever you say about Goldman Sachs, they don't have retail clients. You know, if they're ripping people off, they are, in fact, ripping off sophisticated investors. But the, you know, Wall Street makes its money with brokerage commissions and with churn and with all that other kind of stuff. And you need to know that going in when you're hiring a broker.
Do you recommend that people hire independent financial advisors, those who have no ties? They will charge you for their advice per year or per the size of
your
portfolio.
I think that's a much cleaner system. And I think you're much more likely to find somebody whose interests are aligned with your own interests.
All right. We'll continue with Joe Nocera in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with New York Times columnist Joe Nocera. And okay, Joe, so far the listeners are probably liking you a lot today, ripping into the NCAA excesses and what's going on Wall Street. So now you're going to give them a hard time, I think. You have written positively in recent columns about both fracking and the Keystone XL pipeline, probably the two biggest things to oppose right now for environmentalists. Let's talk about Keystone first. This is the proposed pipeline that would bring oil from Canada's notorious tar sands down through the U.S. to the Gulf of Mexico for refinement. You wrote a piece that began by saying, it will not lead to apocalypse. That's a low bar for an approval matrix. It won't lead to apocalypse. Why did you start there?
Because the environmental movement, by and large, says it will lead to apocalypse. You know, the scientist from NASA has become the leader on this, basically. What is it, you know, if this happens, it's game over for the environment or for the climate? I just don't believe that's true. They make Canada sound like it's a third world country that doesn't know how to, you know, deal with its own environmental set of issues. There's no acknowledgement that the technology has improved radically over the years. That the carbon footprint of Keystone Oil is actually less than some of the oil coming off the coast of California. That there's a whole host of, you know. Here's my view on Keystone. I'm in favor of it for energy security reasons. I think it's really important that we can get oil from Canada as opposed to Venezuela. I think that's an important thing. I think it would help keep the price of oil down. I think it you know, we're not going to we're still going to be an oil economy for a long time, Brian. As much as we would like to all be able to jump into battery-powered cars right now. And speaking of battery-powered cars, the environmentalists are so great about opposing Keystone. Why didn't anybody come out in support of the Chevy Volt when it was having its supposed problems that were really pretty bogus? And so we're going to have an oil economy for a while. Given that reality, isn't it better to get our oil from our friends than from our enemies? That's my core position. And then from that flows these other set of ideas about, you know, does Keystone allow a lot of people to, you know, oppose it while not really having to change their own lifestyle or to do other things that might actually cumulatively have a better effect on the environment? Because you can just say, well, I'm opposing Keystone, this big bad Keystone, but, you know, I can keep my lights on all the time. So that's basically why I support Keystone. And I also think it's infuriating to me the Republicans put Obama in this position where he had to veto it, because if they really had cared about Keystone and it wasn't just a political weapon they were trying to use, they would not have put the president in that position. We would have gotten through the election, and I'm betting anything that he would have approved it.
Larry in Manhattan calling in on Keystone. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Actually, Brian, I'm calling in on a combination, mostly fracking, but also Keystone in this sense.
Okay, keep it tight.
They both are related to the fact of using the same old technologies that we've had of oil, or the same old fuels of oil and natural gas. I urge you and your listeners to Google human waste as fuel, San Antonio, a technology known in the 70s and supposedly suppressed since then, and used in the 70s by farmers with their farm animals manure, that you can make natural gas cleanly by recycling human waste. San Antonio.
Larry, I'm going to leave it there. I want to stay kind of on topic here, but I get your point about that. Greg in Northport, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. We all talk about, lower prices of fuel and energy. We could live with high-cost energy. We may not like it, but we could live with it. If there's even a small percentage that this thing could fail and pollute our aquifers, or fracking could pollute our aquifers, we cannot live without water. So why even take the chance?
Joe.
Well, we've been drilling for natural gas for 50 years, for 100 years, and we've been fracking for 30 or 40 years. And most of the problems around my core belief is that fracking can be done safely if it is regulated properly. And I understand that that creates a whole host of issues, one of which is that fracking is not regulated by the federal government, but it's regulated by the states. Pennsylvania has done a pretty poor job. New York State, let's hope when they approve their rules, they will do it right. That is a problem, no question about it, whether you regulate it properly. Having said that, the core problem that have developed around fracking is actually not the process of fracking or the bringing up of the gas from under the water. And it has more to do with the construction of the well, shoddy well construction, that has allowed the methane to seep out, more methane leakage than is acceptable, and so on and so forth. These are solvable problems, and if you solve them, you get in natural gas a really good bridge fuel from the era of oil, because natural gas is cleaner. It has a smaller carbon footprint than oil. It just does. If you leak a lot of methane in the air, then that raises the carbon footprint like crazy. But if you control that, natural gas is a good bridge fuel, and we should be thinking about that. And the environmental movement should really be pushing to do fracking right, as opposed to be saying, let's stop fracking. Now, Brian, having said all that, I will tell you that the only time I've ever been accosted in the grocery store in New York City is when I wrote a pro-fracking column. So I'm actually a little worried about going outside my apartment after this talk and heading for the subway.
Well, it's really funny, and I'm curious if you feel like an apostate here, because I think it's fair to say you're a progressive on most things. I don't know how you label yourself, but here maybe you digress from your usual political tribe. Is it fair to put it that way?
I think it's not 100%. I see myself as a pragmatist. I don't know if you know who Charlie Peters is at the Washington Monthly.
I don't,
but
actually.
He basically believed that one of the things liberals should be willing to do is criticize liberalism when it's necessary. And so there are a set of issues, energy being one of them, and the plaintiff's bar being another, where I take positions that are radically different from the general readership of the New York Times. I think that's healthy. I think it's good for readers to be challenged, and they can disagree with me, but I think it's good for them to have another point of view coming from somebody who is normally sympathetic to the way they think.
Is it hard for you, intellectually or otherwise, to go against the grain of people you usually agree with, or even who you want to be your fans, or do you get a certain satisfaction from it?
Well,
or both.
When I was 30, I would say it was difficult. As I approach 60, it's not a problem. And, I think I get a little satisfaction. I will say this. I read my reader email very religiously. I don't always answer it because I'm so inundated, but I read it, and I learn from it. And there's no question that my position on fracking, for instance, has evolved even over the last year to where I'm much more sensitized to the regulatory needs and kind of what's wrong with fracking as opposed to what's right with it.
Joe Nocera, columnist for the New York Times, who writes not only about business, his stock and trade for a long time, but also about lots of other things. Among other things, he's got this contest going right now for the stupidest NCAA rule. And I was thinking if you got 64 entries in that contest, you could make brackets, you know, and have your readers vote on the stupidest NCAA trick.
That is brilliant, Brian, and I'm going to do that next March Madness.
Joe Nocera, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay tuned. Coming up, what some people consider stupid Albany tricks and some people consider progress on five major fronts in a marathon session in Albany yesterday. And then we will look at highlights from South by Southwest, tech highlights from South by Southwest. And these do not include the giant Doritos dispenser that they had on display there. Stay with us.